Welcome to a podcast of Textbooks Should Be Great Books, presented by Joy Hackham, the author of the 10-volume K-12 textbook series, A History of Us, and the trade book, Freedom, A History of Us, that accompanies a 16-part PBS series, all published by Oxford University Press. Hackham is also the author of The Story of Science, a 3-volume series co-published by Smithsonian Books and the National Science Teachers Association. This podcast was recorded at the 2012 Text and Academic Authors Association Conference in New Orleans, Louisiana. TAA is the only nonprofit membership association dedicated solely to assisting textbook and academic authors to enhance the quality of textbooks and other academic materials by providing them with educational and networking opportunities. For more information about TAA, visit www.taaonline.net.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here. My history books are a history of us. There's a pun there, as a 10-year-old told me. So, and I do write for younger readers. I know most of you or many of you write for college texts. It's a different world. I don't know your world, and maybe I'll tell you a little bit about mine. A few years ago, I was working in my garden. It was spring, and I had a flat of flowers to plant. I put them down on the left side of a large flower bed, just as a neighbor came by to watch and talk. But as soon as I began digging, I discovered shoots that needed transplanting. So I carried them to the right side of the flower bed, where I found much to do. My friend followed. I'd hardly settled in when I noticed a spot in the middle of the bed filled with tall weeds. I headed there to deal with the weeds. My neighbor, an incredibly well-organized woman, couldn't believe my gardening method, or lack of same. "Don't you ever stick with anything?" she asked. The truth is, I have a hard time doing it. I'm inclined to flit about, which is what I'm going to do today. I have several subjects on my mind, so I hope you'll stay with me as I traipse around the textbook garden. I'd like to talk about a major intellectual change that is brewing worldwide and beginning to impact informed thinking. I'll tell you a bit about my adventures writing story-based history and science books, and then something about textbooks and the astonishing impact that they can have with commentary from some great textbook writers. To start with a big thought, for as long as we've had that thing called culture, no matter when or where we lived, we humans have asked the same vital questions. Who are we? Where did we come from? And where did Earth and this universe that we inhabit come from? We began answering those questions with what we now call myths. In the Americas, thinkers described a great turtle that carried another turtle on its back and another. It was turtles all the way, and they supported Earth. About 3,000 years ago, in the Middle East, some amazing prophets told the story of a creation that took 7 days. Which may have been a metaphor for a great expanse of time. Theirs was a wisdom story. It was not science, which depends on proofs. Meanwhile, there were thinkers from as far back as we have records who were trying to find provable scientific answers to those creation questions. That wasn't easy. For the most part, they didn't have the wherewithal to garner the proofs they needed. Then, just before 1600, a Polish priest named Copernicus figured out that the sun is the center of what then seemed to be the universe. You know that story and how it impacted a charismatic professor in Italy named Galileo. It would take about 200 years before most people and most authorities could accept the scientific proofs that Earth circles the sun and not vice versa. When that happened, we began embracing what is now known as the scientific revolution. It was an enormous paradigm change in human thought. Something as big as that revolution is occurring right now. I believe our time will be seen as the end of one era and the beginning of a whole new one. We, as textbook writers, need to be aware of what's going on. For the first time in human history, we actually know how the universe began. It was with a bang, a big bang. We have the information, and we have the proofs. We now know and can prove that our home Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. We know that there was single-celled life here on Earth 3.8 billion years ago. We have the fossils that prove it. We know those single cells were already divided into life's three domains, bacteria, archaea, and eukaryota, and that all carried the same information system informed by RNA and DNA. That shared code strongly suggests a common ancestor. From where did those creatures come? Who was the common ancestor? Those are questions we can't yet answer, but we're working on them. We do know that Darwin's tree of life, with its two branches of plants and animals, is way off. We know the prokaryote and eukaryote division, still in many textbooks, isn't right either. We can establish the antiquity of life's three domains, all of which are still with us today, but we don't know their origin. That is today's big scientific question. The search to answer it has become a kind of holy grail quest, among the most exciting of all human time. That search is not only absorbing the scientific world, where evolutionary science is impacting all the others, it has been embracing philosophers, religious leaders, and other big thinkers. Our readers, especially our young readers, need a picture of this astonishing dynamism. It's a challenging and very important task. Now to another part of the garden. I was a newspaper reporter 33 years ago when I read Francis Fitzgerald's book, America Revised. Its subtitle is What History Textbooks Have Taught Our Children About Their Country and How and Why Those Textbooks Have Changed in Different Decades. The book, which was serialized in The New Yorker, tells a sorry tale of the then-current history textbooks, comparing them with books children had read early in the 20th century. It's a story of the demise of the thoughtful, well-written textbook and the rise of the formulaic publisher-managed text. I had no idea then, but that book would begin a process that changed my life. Fitzgerald made it clear that there was a time when textbook writers, like other writers, made the major decisions on the books they wrote. The most popular book in American schools in the early decades of the 20th century, a book that broke all kinds of sales records, was David Muzzey's American History. Published in 1911, it stayed in print for 65 years, was a huge bestseller, and made several generations of Americans devotees of American history. At a time before a high wall divided text and trade, Muzzey was the popular spokesperson for American history. His book dominated the field. I found a used copy. What's it like? Like most good books, it reflects the ideas and intelligence of its author, attributes that a textbook industry, soon to take over the field, would not appreciate. Muzzey embraced what once seemed enlightened ideas on issues of race and ethnicity. Today, we wouldn't see them that way. And that's one of the things about writing history, or any textbook, that makes you humble. Even the best of our interpretations reflect our times. We all know that the next generation of teachers and students will want the past reinterpreted to reflect their concerns and values. About the same time that I read Fitzgerald, I also read Harriet Tyson's A Conspiracy of Good Intentions, which provided another look at American textbooks. I've always loved the title, A Conspiracy of Good Intentions. Tyson's thesis is that no one intends to write or publish a dull book, but the publisher-directed methods of producing textbooks makes those dull texts almost a certainty. She made it clear that the primary goal of textbook publishers is to make money, not to educate. Those two books were resonating in my mind when I learned of a meeting to be held in Richmond, Virginia, with the intent of tackling the textbook issue. I was a newspaper reporter in Norfolk, where I had worked with some terrific editors. Looking back, I feel tremendously lucky to have been part of what I now see as a golden age of American journalism. A daily newspaper is relentless. It's coming out tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, so late work is unacceptable. The two papers where I'd worked, the Virginian Pilot and the Ledger Star, had high, no excuses accepted standards. Much of the staff, and almost all the editors, had come out of the iconic journalism school at Chapel Hill. "Good writing is good thinking," said one of the editors, who terrified me. I was the first woman he'd hired to be part of his inner sanctum, but because he was a Southern gentleman, he didn't feel free to yell and swear at me as he did with my colleagues. I made a few colossal errors. He was right to be furious. But he didn't know how to express fury with a woman. I was afraid I might be responsible for a heart attack. I can still see him turning purple. I quickly learned you got things right or you didn't work for him for long. One of my colleagues actually threw up. Yes, he ran for the bathroom when that editor-in-chief did a number on a story he'd written. In hindsight, it was great training that I'm glad is behind me. So there I was, a trained writer, when I read the Fitzgerald and Tyson books. They made it clear that American textbooks, especially history textbooks, were shabby and were impacting learning in America's schools. Those books spoke to me. I had started out as a teacher. I even had a master's degree in education. While I had become a journalist, I had an abiding interest in schools. Besides, my husband and I have three children, and one of them had just brought home a world history text that was beyond dull. It was unreadable. I was teaching a writing class. I used that text as an example of how not to write. So when the Virginia State Board of Education called a meeting to discuss textbooks, I was eager to know more. I learned that someone had shown the board the language arts text used in most Virginia high schools. It included Romeo and Juliet, a fine choice. But wherever Shakespeare had a difficult or arcane world, the publisher had changed it, with no indication to the reader that the changed words weren't Shakespeare's. Yeah, that disturbed the education board, as it should have, and they began looking into other high school texts, and then middle school texts. Appalled by what they saw, they decided to call a meeting and invite publishers to come to Richmond and discuss how textbooks might be improved. That upcoming meeting and the textbook issue were discussed in articles in Time and Newsweek. As a reporter with a background in the field, I decided to cover the board meeting, so I went to Richmond. The publishers sent their salespeople. Those salespeople were trained to talk about how wonderful their books were, which is what they did. I still remember a good-looking saleswoman in a power suit holding a briefcase who stated the problem from their perspective. The Virginia educators had too many rules. Some of them didn't align with the other states, and that complicated things for publishers. I gasped. An education board member raised an eyebrow and then sighed. She didn't seem to know what to say. Nor did I. I was supposed to write about the meeting. I just couldn't do it. There seemed to be nothing to say. I think today I'd find something, but I didn't then. It was my first look at the textbook publishing world, and what came through loudly was contempt for educators and school children, from those who were exploiting them. But I didn't focus on that. I came home from Richmond aware that there was no current U.S. history for young readers, no good current book, and that there was a stated need for one. I figured if I could write a good U.S. history, the publishing world would fall at my feet. I was an innocent. I had no idea what I was undertaking. I thought I could write a one-volume U.S. history and that would take a year, or at the very most 2 years. As it turned out, it became a 10-book series, in part because I was determined to have small books that wouldn't intimidate my young readers. And it would be 10 years before I had a published book in hand. As for the publishing world falling at my feet, of course that didn't happen. I now chuckle thinking of the rejection letters. I didn't then. Before those rejection letters arrived, there were books to write. Having been a freelance writer, sometimes doing corporate work, I thought in terms of pleasing my clients. I was attempting to write school books. My clients were school children. I needed to know how they reacted to my words and what I could do to reach them. So as soon as I had a bunch of chapters, I called the local school system, where I was known because of my newspaper articles. I told them what I was doing and asked if I could try out some chapters in a classroom. The response was wonderful. An assistant superintendent arranged an 8-week trial using a teacher who taught 2 5th-grade social studies classes. One of her classes had a brand new shiny textbook. The other would use my unillustrated manuscript straight from my then dot matrix printer. She could easily compare methodologies and results. I soon learned that the teacher was unhappy about the whole project. It meant 2 preparations for her. And a few parents were annoyed, actually more than annoyed. Their kids didn't have the colorful new textbook the other 5th graders were getting. But things worked out. 8 weeks later, the class that used my text had a party for me, and the other 5th grade asked if they could read my chapters. The teacher said, if I give students 3 pages to read in the standard textbook, they won't do it. If I give them 10 of your pages, they want more. The children wrote commentary. One letter that I still cherish said, I read your whole book, which should please you because I usually don't read. I'd learned that my storytelling approach worked, but I needed more help from my young readers. I wanted to know what words needed defining and which they already knew. I wanted to know which ideas were difficult and which weren't. I asked those questions of children in a neighborhood school, but I didn't get the answers I was looking for. So I decided to pay children to read manuscript and be my editors. I had learned that when I asked a child to read and comment, they were usually too polite to criticize an adult. But when I turned it into a job and paid my readers, explaining to them the role of the editor, they took the assignment seriously. I wasn't a big spender. I paid children $5 for reading a whole bunch of chapters. I also gave them a formula to use in the margins. Write B for boring. Every child knows that word. G for good, and NC for not clear. Underline the words you don't understand, I told them, and write in any comments you want. In one Civil War chapter, Grant is on a boat in the James River when he sends a wire to Abraham Lincoln inviting the president to spend a few days with him. Why would he send him a piece of wire, my young editor wrote in the margin. And I knew I had some explaining to do. As to words that needed defining, I was astonished. All the 10-year-olds seemed to know the big words that had me worried, but no one knew the word loot, which I used in a chapter on pirates. Would children in other parts of the country react as my Virginia Beach neighbors had? I sent manuscript to a teacher friend in Rochester, New York, to another in Southside, Chicago, to a school on the Denver-Boulder corridor, and to a supervisor in San Diego. That California educator shared chapters with 7 schools in her city. I asked for comments from teachers as well as students. Those I got were enormously helpful. Then the San Diego school superintendent sent me a letter saying he would like to do a citywide trial of the books. Ah me, I couldn't follow through. I had no books, no publisher, and no money. It was while all this was going on that I was sending the manuscript to publishers. I'll spare you details, but every publisher I sent manuscript to turned me down, often with lovely rejection notes. One publisher called saying the books were very good and they needed to be published, but they didn't meet their criteria or agenda or something or other. Another publisher was doing a Virginia history and was looking for writers. I lived in Virginia. I was serving on a committee with some University of Virginia history professors. The daddy of Virginia historians, Virginius Dabney, was a friend and mentor. The Wall Street Journal had published a piece I wrote on Thomas Jefferson. Of course I'd like to do a Virginia history. The publisher was paying writers $250 for a sample chapter. I decided to write about the very colorful convention where Virginia ratified the U.S. Constitution. A parade of founding characters was there, but especially Patrick Henry, who, eloquent as ever, was no longer young and had become a bit dotty. He wore a wig that was too big on his head, and when he gestured and raised his arms, which he did often, he'd hit the wig and it would swing around. All eyes seemed to be on that wig, especially those of the Kentucky sharpshooters who came with their guns and stood in the rear of the hall. George Mason, a kind of senior statesman, refused to sign the document because it didn't outlaw slavery. It was the well-prepared Jemmy Madison who carried the day. If Virginia hadn't ratified, and it wasn't a sure thing, the Constitution would not have become the national document. I wrote that chapter, rewrote, honed, and rewrote again. I don't think there was an extra word anywhere. I still think it may be the best chapter I've ever written. I was sure I would get a contract. Maybe they'd offer me a vice presidency in the publishing house. What I got was a call. The editor on the other end of the line said, "I'm sorry to tell you this, but your chapter won't do." "Why?" I asked. "Well, I don't know how to say this," he replied, "but it just doesn't sound textbooky." He was right. It didn't sound textbooky. Oh, and there was something else wrong with my writing, he told me. We couldn't figure out how to edit it. I got the $250, and he actually offered to let me try again to see if I could write in textbookese. I declined. Meanwhile, I was sending copy to leading educators. Al Shanker, the wonderful head of the AFT, liked what he read and learned that I needed help. By now, we had a son in college and were borrowing money to keep him there. Shanker gave me a bunch of freelance writing assignments and paid me well to do them. Diane Ravitch called. I was thrilled to talk to someone from the big-time educational establishment, but she made me realize I was a bit wacky. "You're courageous to write a book without a contract," she said. I hadn't thought of myself that way. I thought I was acting logically. There was a need for a good U.S. history. I was writing one. Why wasn't the publishing world responding? There were then about 40 Main Street textbook publishers. Today, there are only a few players, and soon there may only be one. The fewer the publishers, the more limited and formulaic books become, because they have to sell to a very broad market and can't offend or challenge anyone. I now know that the textbook industry is a business with business values. Selling books is what's important. Mostly those books have to be brightly designed with a gimmick or two that will make them seem cutting edge. And of course they can't offend anyone. Provocative books? Why would anyone publish one of them? Bad as history textbooks were when Francis Fitzgerald wrote America Revised, there was then at least variety and choice. In recent years, the K-12 field has been dominated by three publishers, Pearson, McGraw-Hill, and Houghton Mifflin. Houghton Mifflin recently announced bankruptcy. Some are predicting that Pearson may become the only major survivor. So one commercial entity may come to own school learning in this country. This has come about for a number of reasons, but certainly the widespread adoption system, where every school and every teacher in a city must use the same text, leads to very lucrative big city and big state adoptions. It has helped create a synergistic relationship between education executives and publishers. And because the stakes are so high, it sometimes leads to big-time corruption. This is a system that pays little or no attention to the opinions of individual teachers, and children's opinions or needs aren't even in the mix. A ditty that I heard again and again in publishing houses goes like this. You don't write books for children because children don't buy books. In much the same way that lobbyists work with congresspeople, textbook salespeople make themselves valuable to school systems, and perhaps in return, the states make the adoption process so expensive that small publishers can't compete. It's a process that makes savvy sales teams essential and keeps out innovation. According to recent articles in the New York Times, the Pearson Foundation has been taking educators, especially state decision makers, on European and Asian junkets. Pearson salespeople come along. And for reasons I can't quite fathom, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been giving tax-exempt money to Pearson. Using a winning tactic, that mega publisher has bought a big-name scientist whose name will be attached to a new science series. It's a system they have perfected. Celebrity authors don't do actual writing, but their prestige names do help with sales. Ghostwriters, mostly teams of underpaid freelancers, do the actual writing. Harriet Tyson described that formula many decades ago. The head of the American Textbook Council commented to me, "It puts a Mercedes in the professor's driveway, and it sells books for the publisher." It's part of a process that lies to teachers and young readers, claiming authorship where it doesn't exist. There is no reason for that process, or for poorly written books, or for a monopolistic textbook establishment. It is garnering big money for a few, while those few steal learning opportunities from our children. In April, the Brookings Foundation published a study that found, in the words of their report, strong evidence that the choice of instructional materials has large effects on student learning, effects that rival in size those that are associated with differences in teacher effectiveness. The report continues, whereas improving teacher quality through changes in the preparation and professional development of teachers is challenging, expensive, and time-consuming, making better choices among available instructional materials should be relatively easy, inexpensive, and quick. Here's still more from that important report. Students learn principally through interactions with people and instructional materials. But education policymakers focus primarily on factors removed from those interactions, such as academic standards, teacher evaluation systems, and school accountability policies. It's as if the medical profession worried about the administration of hospitals and patient insurance, but paid no attention to the treatment that doctors give their patients. In other words, what we textbook writers do is very important, perhaps more important than we realized. But in part because of factors that have been beyond our control, we're not doing a good enough job of it. We're participating in a corrupt endeavor that, and this is what makes it so awful, is impacting our children and our nation's future. Textbooks should be page turners. They should be books that stay with their readers. And some are. But too often, textbook is a synonym for boring. Change is not likely to come from the monopoly that took more than $8 billion in education funds last year. At the very time that teachers are losing their jobs and school arts and activities are being cut to a minimum. What can we writers do? At least insist on honesty. Authors are people who write books. The names of non-writers should not be affixed to school materials. The names of the actual authors should be. We should also fight to get good writing and good thinking into the materials our children read. As you know, I write science books as well as history books. They weren't easily published either, but that's another story. One of my science books, A Narrative Approach to Physics, is named Einstein Adds a New Dimension. Writing it, I spent more than a year under the tutelage of an MIT physicist, Edwin F. Taylor, who volunteered his time to make sure I got things right. Working with him was mind-stretching. Taylor is the author of the best contemporary science text of which I know. Called Space-Time Physics, it's exquisite science, it's eloquent prose, and it begins with a parable. His book, Exploring Black Holes, written in its original edition with the legendary physicist John Archibald Wheeler, is just coming out in a new edition. Edmund Bertschinger, head of the physics department at MIT, is co-author. It's an informed, literate look at general relativity. And to be fair, it is published by Pearson. I want to make it clear my expertise is in the upper elementary and middle school world. College textbooks are beyond my ken. Back to Edmund Taylor, who, as a mentor tutor, instructed me on relativity and quantum theory. Well, we often talked about textbook writing. First, you need to tell a story, said Taylor. Even if that story is implicit, there should be a big picture, a goal, and streams that pour into the river heading for that goal. Of course I agreed. I'm a storyteller and very aware that the great educational psychologists, like Canada's Kieran Egan, see storytelling as the classic way cultures have conveyed important information. Today's brain scientists are suggesting that stories are a characteristically human way of learning, part of what differentiates us from our animal cousins. But for textbook writers, those stories can't be fuzzy. As Edwin Taylor put it, the information must be correct and up to date. I reminded him, that's why I turned to experts like you for review and insights. He made a third, and for him, crucial point. The book must have a human point of view because science is essentially a human enterprise. Now, I had questions. As a writer of story-based history, I have always thought in human terms, but science had changed my thinking. I was beginning to think in terms of the whole universe, with stars and planets and life forms, all part of a grand story that is no longer human-centric. Science is a human enterprise. That isn't the way I usually thought of it. For me, science was just out there with laws and a history for us humans to discover. Something Taylor had read made him think differently. It gave him insights I'm still struggling to reach. He told me those insights came from a textbook that impacted his thinking with ideas that have never left him. Let me tell you about that textbook. Albert Einstein's friend, Leopold Infeld, needed some income. Einstein tried to get him a job at Princeton, but couldn't manage it. So Infeld came up with the idea that they would write a textbook on physics together. But when he went to Einstein to explain what he had in mind, Infeld got so flustered he couldn't say what he wanted. His tongue was tied in knots. Einstein understood. This is not a stupid idea, he said. Not stupid at all. We shall do it. Out of that came their amazing textbook, The Evolution of Physics from Early Concepts to Relativity and Quanta. Published in 1938, it became a great success. Physicist Stephen Hawking would later describe the book as a revolution. It includes a concept that is guided by MIT friend. Here it is in Einstein's words. Physical concepts are free creations of the human mind and are not, however it may seem, determined by the external world. Let me repeat that, changing it a bit to clarify. Physics is a free creation of the human mind and is not determined by the external world. Taylor has embraced that thought. I'm still struggling to understand it. But what is wonderful about big concepts, and the 10-year-olds I write for understand this, those concepts can stick in your mind and they can change you. Here's a bit more on Einstein and Enfeld's book. Its two physicist authors had a mutual friend, Max Born. All three met in Berlin when Einstein and Born were young professors and Enfeld a student. Later, Max Born, no slouch as a physicist, became a Nobel Prize winner, as did, of course, Albert Einstein. All three were forced to flee Germany. Einstein ended up in the United States, Enfeld in Canada, and Max Born in England, where today he's mostly remembered as the grandfather of pop singer Olivia Newton-John. Like his two friends, Born was a wonderful writer. Aware of their project and eager to encourage them, Max Born wrote these words about textbooks. To present a scientific subject in an attractive and stimulating manner is an artistic task similar to that of a novelist or even a dramatic writer. The same holds for writing textbooks, which is the thought I'd like to leave with you. Textbook writing is, or should be, an artistic task. What we do is very important. We do need to do nothing less than write great books. Books good enough to inspire and educate a generation of learners. Thank you.
Thank you, Joy.
Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions if anyone has any.
We are recording the session, so if you could wait till I get over to you with the microphone, that'd be great.
Yes. Whoops, she's got it.
Your story about your book that you got all the rejections on, so Oxford University Press, that step, what happened? Right?
That's another speech, but no, I went to a cocktail party in Colonial Williamsburg, and I met a historian that I knew, and by this time I had all these teachers who had all this stuff going for me except a publisher, and so I was telling my historian friend, and he said, I know someone in New York who can help you, and so I sent, and that man's name is Byron Hollinshead, and he had been president of Oxford, and so I sent him the manuscript. By this time, I think I had about 5 books done. It was a big box. And so he read it, and he liked it. And he said, oh, and all of his peers are publishers. I mean, this was his field. So he said, I'm sure I can get that published, no problem. He sent it around to his, he's actually told the story, and he sent it around to all of his friends and got the exact same reaction. Great, great manuscript, Byron, and it should be published, but it doesn't fit, And so this went on for quite a while. Eventually, because of his Oxford contacts, I said he had been president of Oxford. Oxford had never published children's things in this country. So they liked the idea of starting out with 10 books. I mean, if they're going to, and so he talked them into it. I won't even go into that. This is interesting because they hired as the editor someone who came from the world. She hated my books right away. They've sold 5 million copies. It worked out, but not easily.
One of the themes I take from your talk is a word you may or may not have used, and that's passion, that the textbook writer should be passionate, the prose should be passionate. And I wonder, how does one accomplish that when dealing with truths that should be perhaps in air quotes in lower case because they haven't achieved consensus yet, and publishers and adopters may quite legitimately say, I don't care so much about your opinion about this issue. I really want to hear either the journalistic maxim of this person says this, the people on the other side say that, or articulating a middle ground. And let's just use as one example, since I write in the area of communication law, the Patriot Act. It's very easy when writing introductory chapters in such books to talk about historical examples of excesses, government excesses in time of war, whether it's Espionage Act or Alien and Sedition Act, et cetera. Harder to achieve consensus in talking about something that's going on right now, even if the author might feel it passionately. How do you deal with moments in writing history or science when you might feel passionate about something, but you perhaps also recognize that there are other points of view and those people might feel passionately too?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the difficulties, particularly about writing history. And I try very hard because I'm conscious that I'm writing for young people. I try hard to balance both points of view. Once in a while, I lose it, I think, but mostly I don't. My books have a voice, and a lot of textbooks don't. I think the voice comes through, but my history books go through the Obama election. I will say that, you know, when you write U.S. history and the books are reused around the country, people care. And I've done pretty well because I think I think there is a basic honesty in what I write, and generally people recognize that. But I have had, zealots on both sides of the spectrum attack me. And nobody seems to care what I said about George Washington, but they certainly care what I say about Ronald Reagan. You just do your best.
Mary Kay, can you wait just a minute? I'll bring the microphone over.
Do you have a question, Mary Kay? Or?
Yes, I wonder if you would talk a little bit about the relationship between doing your research and the actual writing. You know, what is involved in going from one to the other?
I mean, the difference, the relationship between doing my research and the actual writing. I just served on a panel in Washington. It was kind of interesting. There were five writers, all of them very good, you know, from my perspective. I was kind of awed with the company I was keeping. And the first man got up there and told the process of writing his books. And before he, pen to paper, but before he, you know, whatever, started the keyboard, he had something like a 250-page outline. I mean, he did all of his work before he actually starts writing. I was stunned. I was a kid who, back in high school, when we learned how to write outlines, and we had to turn in an outline every time we did a paper for the English teacher, I'd write the paper because I didn't know how to outline it until I had it finished. You know, so I don't do outlines. I don't do preparation. What I do, I write on very diverse subjects, and I write as a journalist does, out of curiosity rather than knowledge. I'm not a professor of anything. So I'm writing about evolutionary biology right now. So, okay, I just jump into the field. It's usually way a bit over my head. Certainly physics was when I started. And I get an idea. I look for something that's going to, you know, be a story, and I write it up. So I have, that's in a sense my outline. And then I go out and do the next level of research. And then I go back and rewrite, and then I do more research. And so I'm constantly writing it. I may do 50 or more revisions before I finish a chapter. And I'm usually writing four or five chapters. I mean, I'm really disorganized. I told you about my garden. I'm not a really There have to be more efficient ways of working, but you do what you do what you can.
Whatever you do works. My grandson loves your books,
and
he is a merit scholar. He's going into college. He still references them, and he loves history. You turned him on to history. And I wonder where you got the idea of doing those interesting little side notes that you have about, for example, the use of fans in an era and so on.
Well, yeah, if you read my books, particularly the history books, you'll see there's lots of sidebars.
Yes.
And it's a device that helps me as a storyteller, because you really, you know, if you have a compelling story, you want your readers to go from chapter to chapter. You want them. When you're writing, particularly for schools, there are facts that you have to put in, or you're not going to get adopted. So if those facts interrupt the story, the flow of the story, you go into a sidebar, so that someone who's on a committee can check it off and say she's got that. I mean, the other thing is, I started out with the idea of just doing footnotes, and one of my sons drew a picture of a foot with a little note card in its toes, and that was all going to be in the bottom of the page. And I was, originally when I was in San Diego, and people were, kids and teachers were reading the copy, I got these notes. Your sidebars are more interesting than your tag. We want more sidebars. So it kind of evolved. But it isn't. It is. There is a problem with the facts that you have to, as textbook writers, that you have to put in, and that often makes the prose wooden. So just pulling it out and putting it on the side. And I mentioned Byron Hollinshead, who has become my agent, and who got Oxford for me and Smithsonian, and Byron has produced all the books for both those publishers, and he's very good. So the layouts are his. It helps to have sort of custom-made books.
This question has two parts. First, what is on your horizon as a writer? You've given some hints as to what you're working on now. And the second part goes with it, so it should be easy to remember, which is, what are your habits as a writer? Do you write in the morning? Do you set apart a block of time? Or do you just kind of fit it in during the day? What are you working on now, and how are you working?
Okay, I'm working... I'm working on two books on evolutionary biology. Oh, my gosh. I have a lot of people who read my books who seem to love my writing who are not going to be happy. Just the word evolution is upsetting. It's the great science of our time. When I wrote these three books on physics, I thought, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. After this, it's going to be a piece of cake. Nothing will be as hard again. Well, evolutionary biology is an astonishing science. As I say, I don't write out of expertise. I write as the gee whiz kid who gets thrown into the subjects. But one of my secrets is I go to the very best people. And as you say, my Edwin Taylor at MIT is just the great writer on physics. And in evolutionary biology, Carl Woese at University of Illinois is one of the great thinkers of our time. I find that if I go out there and say I'm writing for kids, or even on the college level, the best people want to help you. I mean, I started out with my history books, sort of going to some lower level historians, and they were too busy for me. When I went to the very best, they had plenty of time. David McCullough has been very supportive. James McPherson, I go to experts. I just say, I don't know what I'm doing. You better help me, because this may influence some kids. Whatever. My schedule, I try and write every morning for, say, 3 hours, 7 days a week if I can. I mean, I have a family. I have, they come first, kind of. I mean, I now have 5 grandchildren. But if there isn't a family thing, I try and write every day. And then in the afternoon, I either do research or I go out and, get on my bicycle, whatever.
I'll hand it to you next. Thanks so much for all these wonderful thoughts. And
I wanted to just go back for a second to the to the history topic area and pull on the threads of including facts and balancing points of view. I was kind of interested to think about your view of or story of textbooks history, starting with higher quality and, you know, losing that sense of individuality and quality, because the story that I've really been following as I grew up was the exclusion of diversity and important stories like Native American history. And I sort of grew up with Howard Zinn's work. So I'm wondering if you could speak a little more towards what you've faced and dealt with in the struggle to include true diversity and the true makers of American history.
Yeah, I mean, just including diversity is not a problem today, and in part because of Howard Zinn, but because that's where we are. And so today the problem is a lot of textbooks have they'll throw in an ethnic group for no reason at all, just because we've got to have this ethnic group and this ethnic group. And so I'm very conscious of diversity and try to write about the spectrum of Americans. You will not find textbooks out there that aren't at least as far as I know, that aren't inclusive. I mean, that. Oh, Texas, yeah, there was just. I don't know if you. The New York Review of Books just wrote a. I mean, there are some wackos in Texas, there's just no question about it. But, there also are, there's a teacher in Texas who's got to be one of the greatest history textbooks teachers in the country, and in fact she took my history textbooks and used them with a few years ago with Katrina refugees who had been come into Dallas, I think, and she used them to teach reading because these are sort of high interest books and got reading scores that went up 10%, 12%, and 14%. People in Austin that I know, that educators, are terrific. Somehow, the thinking people in Texas get around a lot of the nonsense. Sometimes they don't. But the big problem in Texas, and this is the problem with textbook adoptions, is that in order to get adopted, you have to send a sales team to every town and city and hamlet in the state to do that, because they all have adoption cycles. They have an adoption process. You have to present on Tuesday the 3rd, and if you're not there presenting, your books don't get adopted. That's enormously expensive. So small publishers like mine cannot field those sales staffs. And so, as we say, there are only three publishers, and there may be only one doing it. And the other thing about it, Texas particularly, when they have this adoption cycle, you have to send them a huge number of books. The idea is that, that everybody in every committee and everywhere is going to get a book to look at. That, I heard a librarian in Texas say, "Oh, it's just so great. We get all these freebie books." They're not freebie. The textbooks are outrageously expensive. I mean, my books, if you look at the science books, which are gorgeous, if you buy them for schools in quantity, it's like $17 a book. I mean, they're very inexpensive. The history books are $11. The textbooks are $70, $80, $90, whatever. So there's just this insidious or incestuous relationship between the adoption process. There are people on these committees who, Kansas and evolution, or biology, that's the problem. But I see the lack of a free, open market, the fact that there aren't lots of books out there, I see that as a much, much greater problem.
I would like to add my own thanks for a fine talk, and I want to ask if you have any experience with looking around the world and what the situation is in the teaching of history or any other subjects, and how does the U.S. compare to the approach that's taken, say, in France or in Asia?
Well, my science books have been translated into Korean, so they're in Korean schools, which is really nice. It's a leap here. I take a historian's approach to science, which history carries the story, and we don't do that. We teach science pretty much in terms of hands-on activities. And hands-on, when we were raising our kids, if a science teacher did hands-on, I thought, that's what I want. That's great. I've come to learn that a lot of hands-on is just a big crock. It's fun. You know, you do these great experiments. It's just everybody has a ball. But then ask the kids 2 or 3 weeks later what they did or why. Or there has to be a story with it. And we kind of we don't do that. As far as other countries, right now Finland is the country everybody's talking about. Finland schools were pretty poor, I guess, 20, 25 years ago, and they were determined to do something about it. And mainly what they did was change their approach, their attitude toward teachers, and made teaching in K-12 a position of respect, and they don't do testing. They trust their teachers. I mean, there's a lot being written on Finland, and it's interesting. We're abusing our teachers right now. I mean, it's outrageous what we're doing to teachers. I mean, I have one of the people who's helping me with my biology now is a fabulous, an incredible high school teacher. He was a field biologist for 7 or 8 years and then went into teaching, and this is a man who has a calling. I mean, he is a great teacher and a great biologist. And his student, I mean, MIT and Stanford come to his classroom to recruit. This guy is just great. His salary has been cut for each of the last 3 years. All the teachers in his town, but we're not going to keep teachers unless we start respecting them.
Thank you very much for an engaging and inspirational talk.
Thank you.
I haven't read your works yet, but if they are anything equal to your inspiration as a speaker, I know they are very great and very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Those nice words.
Thank you. It's true. A couple of questions. I want to just follow up on the question about diversity and then just ask you another question, just a factual question. The question about diversity has to do with the lack of information often about the Native American experience in our textbooks. And recently, studying the African American experience, I came across an interesting fact, which most of you may already know, but I didn't know, that in December of 1862, 38 Native Americans were lynched in Mankato, Minnesota. The next month, we have the Emancipation Proclamation. And I never seen this in any textbook at all. I never saw this juxtaposition or discussion of Lincoln or anything like that. And I just wonder how you deal with a Native American perspective on the loss of a continent. That's the first comment. And the second one is I think you made a statement that we don't know the common ancestors. We don't know our common ancestors.
I was talking about microbes.
Pardon?
I was talking about microbes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Because I do know the mitochondria DNA argument from Alan Wilson and Rebecca Kahn points to the fact that 7 billion people in the world are basically, we have genetic material from a woman in East Africa. I mean, that is a part. So those are my two parts.
The genetic bit is in the books that I'm writing now, if I can find a publisher. as far as Native Americans and Black Americans, look at my books. You can't tell all. There's so many stories that you can't tell. But for me, the book that I wrote that was most jolting, personally was the book on Reconstruction. When I had studied Reconstruction, it was just a totally different story than what we tell today. And reading a lot of the slave narratives, I guess I'd never thought of slavery in terms of sex, all of these women who were victims, and the slave narratives are clear on that. You know, I'm writing for kids, so there isn't much sex in my books, but I think I do a pretty good job. But I will tell you one other thing. You know, I told you something about the fact that I kept going to teachers and I kept going to children. So I read something that just enraged me. I mean, I just lost it about the whole black experience. And so I wrote this one chapter in which pretty much I trashed whites, and I don't even remember what I said. But anyway, it was a very tough chapter on slavery and the whole experience. I then took it to a classroom where I was working with kids. The teacher was black, and the class was about 50-50. So I'm reading the chapter about the awfulness of slavery, but, you know, I'm making it clear that the slaves were victims and that some white people are pretty bad. And there's this little black boy that I had, who's adorable. It's just this kid who his skin couldn't hold in all the energy. And I had been in that classroom before, and I sort of fell in love with this kid. He's sitting right in front of me, and the more I read this chapter, the more I can see he is just dying. That he's just miserable. He's just curling up, and he wants to go away and have me go away. And so I just stopped in the middle of the chapter and read something else. And then I went home and I called this guy I know at the Schoenbrunn. Is that the name of the library in New York? And I said, I don't know what's going on, but this chapter was very disturbing to not only to this little boy, but to all the African-American kids in this classroom. And he said, of course. He said, these kids get along with each other, and you're introducing something if kids go out on the playground and play slave and master, nobody wants to be the slave. They don't want to be, you know, reminded of they're not adults. They're taking this in a different way than adults do. And just be careful. Don't overdo that story. So that made me rethink some of, you know, I think a lot of critics of books look at them from our adult perspective. Children are different. So you, and I will have to say, I mean, essentially, I wrote for those middle school kids. I think that's just such an important time. That's when we lose kids. By high school, you know, they're separated out into the ones who are going to be successful and not successful. I would write differently if I had high school kids in mind. And my books, interestingly, they're being used in some high schools. They're being used in some college classrooms. But my target was the 10, 11, 12-year-olds.
Yep. I thank you so very much for your words and your inspiration and for the resilience that is necessary to have in order to be able to be published as a textbook author in the United States. I'd like to tackle the issue of diversity. I'm not going to do that because it has already been talked about. Although I haven't read your work, I'm so sorry about that, but I your books just struck me as one of the few examples I've seen here in the United States as textbooks student-oriented, pretty much oriented to the learning process instead of to the teaching process. And this is exactly where I'd like to relate to the diversity issue, because these dialogue boxes that you use on the margins, to what extent could they be used? And this is a question I ask of you. How can... if you ever thought or think or into using these dialogical boxes to integrated knowledge, I mean to knowledge that can or to links that can lead students to diverse experiences that really talk to their own experiences and make them subjects of the learning process instead of being subjects of a teaching process that is mainly dominated by the mainstream perspective of looking at American history. Thank you.
I'm a little fuzzy on what the question, but the sidebars, they serve a lot of purposes for me. First of all, there are great teaching materials that go with my books. The books were discovered by a team of an educator team at Johns Hopkins, and they used the books in at-risk schools and did their own teaching materials. And I was sitting at my computer one day, and I got a message that said, we've done teaching materials to go with your books. Would you like to see them? Yeah. and so they have now done in Oxford, or you can get them on Amazon. They use a lot of the stuff from those sidebars. I also use the sidebars, particularly in the science books, to go farther. You know, you're sitting there, you're standing there as a teacher, and you've got 25 kids, and they go from children who don't know a whole lot or are struggling to some who are very sophisticated in any typical class. So, you know, and I've got this book on quantum theory and relativity. I mean, I sort of extract some of the very difficult ideas and put them in the sidebar so that there's a basic narrative that anybody could read. But for the few children who want to really go farther, there's a sidebar, or there's a sidebar for especially, you know, it just helps with young readers. I think maybe with any readers to do that. It's disturbing to some teachers who, you know, have never seen that kind of approach. They should read somebody else's book. I don't, you know, whatever. It works for me, and it seems to work for a lot of kids.
Thank you for your compelling description of the condition of textbook publishing today. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what advice you'd have for us as sort of budding textbook writers, given this era.
What's going on is outrageous. And it's like the 1%, the banking 1%, or the executives who are making. If you just earn $1 million a year, you're not very successful in the business world today. I mean, you've got to earn 10 or 15 or 20 or more million a year. And the same, you know. So we have a business establishment that is, completely separate from the rest of us, and it's causing all kinds of problems. The same thing is true in textbooks. We have these very few publishers who make huge amounts of money, and that money next year they've got to make a little more to make their stockholders or whomever happy. That's, you don't go into teaching or writing for students, you know, with that as your prime goal. I mean, I don't know. Write your congressman. I went to I was in Washington one week, and I went to two places. One was the American Publishing Association, and I said to the head of the American Publishing Association, I said, authors are people who write books, and the American Publishing Association should come up with some sort of guidelines that say you can't put names on books, you know, that, I mean, names that say author and they're not the author. And this woman who was head of the organization said to me, our lawyers say there's nothing illegal about it. And there's the door, lady, get out of here. And that, you know, somehow we've just got to stand up to, ghostwriters are, you expect a ghostwriter if it's a movie star. I mean, and more and more of them now are giving credit, actually, to the ghostwriters. But you don't expect a Harvard professor to have a ghostwriter. And that's the kind of thing that's happening today. And there's just the university should, if you have any clout there, the university should say, we don't do this. If you're an, and what's appalling about it is if a college professor were to put his name on a college level or whatever, on a published piece of work that he didn't write or she didn't write, they'd lose their jobs the next day. But it's okay with kids. It's not okay. The history textbook that I know best was one published by Houghton Mifflin about maybe 14, 15 years ago, and it's got four professors, one of them University of California professor, good writer. He's a really good writer. But when he was interviewed about the book, and he said, you know, I was working on something. I never had time to read it. So his name is there, and you open the page, and there he was, you know, meet our authors. And you know, so, you know, it's beyond me.
Can you make a brief comment about Christopher Reeve and his brother and PBS, the PBS series?
Oh, yeah. So A History of Us, the history books, became sort of the basis, the base for a 16-part PBS series, and called Freedom, A History of Us. So we sort of extracted the freedom ideas. And Christopher Reeve, who had a brother who was a history teacher, became involved with getting people in Hollywood to be the voices. Well, nobody was going to turn him down. So the voices on this thing, I mean, my husband knows who all the actors, everybody that you've ever heard of is in these, they're now videos that are available for schools. It was a 16-part special. Anyway, the book went out of print for a while. It's coming back now. By the end of the year, it should be published. So it's called Freedom, A History of Us, and it's kind of a one-volume U.S. history with the 16-part video series to go with it.
Thank you so much, Joy. That was a terrific presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Books Should Be Great Books is an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.